Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments.
Today, we're tackling a question that has always fascinated me. It's about a ghost print on the shores of history, a first contact that almost wasn't. What if the first Europeans to land in the Americas simply never did?
Exactly. For me, this is personal. I grew up absolutely devouring the Norse sagas, the stories of Eric the Red, of Leif Erikson. These weren't just myths. These were tales of real, audacious explorers pushing the boundaries of their known world in a longship. The idea that they reached North America, a full 500 years before Columbus, is just staggering.
It really is. And my fascination comes from the other side of that shore. We talk so much about the discovery of America, but the Norse were there, however briefly. They met the indigenous peoples they called the Skraeling. So the question that always gets me is, what happens if that single fragile thread of contact is cut before it's even woven?
It changes everything. It's a tantalizing thought experiment. So today, we're going to venture into that alternate past. We're going to imagine a world where the Viking longships battling the icy North Atlantic either turn back, get lost, or perhaps never even set out from Greenland in the first place.
The ripples from that single non-event could reshape the world. How would the timeline of global exploration shift? Would the great European powers still launch their Age of Discovery in the same way, at the same time? And most profoundly, what would it mean for the civilizations of the Americas? Join us as we explore a world where the Vikings' unseen voyage remained unseen.
So, let's start right there, on the edge of the world, in Greenland. Eric the Red's colony. It's already hanging on by a thread, isn't it? A marginal existence, utterly dependent on a lifeline back to Iceland and Norway.
It really is. Pastoral farming on the edge of a glacier. They arrived during a medieval warm period, which was a stroke of luck. But it was never going to last. Their entire economy was basically propped up by one luxury good: walrus ivory.
And when the market for that ivory collapses in Europe and the climate starts to cool, that lifeline gets very, very frayed. So in our timeline, they have the Vinland sagas. They have this knowledge, this tantalizing hope of a land rich with resources they desperately need, especially timber.
Yeah, timber. You can't overstate that. Greenland is essentially treeless. They're building with turf and driftwood. The idea of a land with massive forests, a short sail away, it must have felt like a miracle. So, if that discovery is never made, if Bjarni Herjolfsson corrects his course and never sights that coastline,
then that hope, that potential safety valve, just isn't there. Does that accelerate the colony's collapse? Or does it paradoxically make them focus inward, maybe adapt better to their environment, because they aren't chasing a dream across the Davis Strait?
Oh, that's a sharp question. My gut says it accelerates the end. I think hope is a resource, just like food or iron. Without the stories of Vinland, without the possibility of a better place, the psychological toll of the encroaching ice and the isolation would be immense. Every failed crop, every ship that doesn't arrive from Norway, feels that much more final.
So the Greenland colony just withers away, maybe a few decades earlier than it did in our history. A silent end. And the most profound consequence of that is that the knowledge of a Western continent dies with them. It never becomes a saga. It never gets written down. It's not even a rumor in the courts of Europe.
Exactly. That's the first and maybe the biggest ripple. The ghost print we talked about is completely erased. In our timeline, the Vinland sagas were obscure, yes, but they existed. A seed of an idea was planted. But in this alternate world, for the next 500 years, the Atlantic Ocean has nothing on the other side. It is a true, terrifying, world-ending ocean.
But would that have actually stopped anyone? I mean, were 15th century explorers in Portugal and Spain really consulting the Norse sagas? The push for exploration then was driven by hard economics. The fall of Constantinople. The need for a new route to the spices of the East.
I don't think they were reading the sagas, no. But I'm talking about something more fundamental. A sort of cartographic imagination. The idea that there could be something out there. Without even a whisper of the Norse voyages, does the psychological barrier to sailing west become that much bigger? Does Columbus's mad idea seem not just risky, but cosmically absurd?
So you're saying the lack of a precedent, even an almost forgotten one, might have been enough to tip the scales. To make investors and monarchs say, no, it's impossible, the ocean is endless. Focus on going around Africa.
It might. Think about it. Every myth from Atlantis to St. Brendan's Isle puts land in the Atlantic. The Norse story was different because it was real. Removing that one single piece of factual evidence, however tenuous, leaves a void. And in that void, fear and the belief in an empty sea might just have been strong enough to delay that push west. Not forever, but perhaps by a generation.
A generation? That's a powerful thought. But are we giving that single, flimsy story too much credit? I mean, the economic engine of the 15th century was a juggernaut. You have the Ottomans effectively slamming the door on the land routes to Asia. You have the Portuguese crown pouring fortunes into getting around Africa. It feels inevitable that someone would eventually just try sailing west, sagas or no sagas.
Oh, I don't think it stops the impulse. Not at all. But it changes the risk profile dramatically. Think of Columbus's sales pitch to Ferdinand and Isabella. It was already borderline insane. He was fundamentally wrong about the size of the planet. Now, take away the last little whisper, the last cartographic ghost of a possibility that land is out there. His pitch goes from being a high-risk gamble to a fool's errand. The money, the ships, the political will, it might just flow to the more sensible route around Africa.
So the focus shifts. Instead of a race west, it becomes an absolute all-in obsession with the route east. The Portuguese, who were already leading the way, basically win the first leg of the race uncontested. Vasco da Gama reaches India in 1498, and that becomes the singular event of the age.
Right. And for the next 50 years, maybe more, all of Europe's maritime energy is directed into the Indian Ocean. It's about breaking the Venetian Mamluk spice monopoly. Spain, instead of being flooded with Aztec gold and Potosi silver, is left on the sidelines, desperately trying to compete with Portugal's direct line to the riches of the East. The entire balance of power in Europe could be redrawn.
Wow. Okay. That really lands. And while all of this is playing out, this European squabble over pepper and cloves, the Americas are gifted, what, another half century? Three quarters of a century of complete, uninterrupted development.
At least. And that's not just a pause. That's a transformative amount of time. Let's look at the Triple Alliance, the Aztec Empire. When Cortes arrived in 1519, it was a vast and powerful entity. But it was also brittle. It was built on the subjugation of other city-states, many of whom were resentful and ready to join an outsider.
The Tlaxcalans being the prime example. They were the linchpin of his entire strategy.
They were. So give that empire another 75 years. What happens? Does it collapse under its own weight? or does it do the opposite? Does it have time to consolidate, to move from a tributary empire to a more integrated centralized state? Does it have time to turn those resentful subjects into loyal citizens?
If it does, if the Tlaxcalans and others are more thoroughly integrated by, say, 1590, then the European arrival looks completely different. You don't have a few hundred conquistadors leveraging a massive civil war. You have a few hundred men landing on the shores of a unified and potentially hostile superpower.
They would have been wiped out. I mean, it's not even a question. The technological gap wasn't that extreme. The Spanish advantages were steel, horses, and disease. But their most potent weapon was political destabilization. Take that away, and their expedition is likely a historical footnote, a failed landing, a cautionary tale.
And the Inca, the timing there is even more critical, isn't it? Pizarro arrived at the absolute perfect moment of weakness, at the very end of a devastating civil war between the brothers Huascar and Atahualpa.
He walked into a power vacuum he couldn't have possibly understood. He was just phenomenally, historically lucky. Delay that arrival by 50 years. The Civil War is ancient history. The victor, or his successor, is firmly in charge of a healed, unified empire. Pizarro's tiny force would have been utterly insignificant against the full might of the Inca state.
So, they're not just footnotes. Pizarro, Cortez, they become these almost mythical failures. Cautionary tales told in the taverns of Seville. Don't go west. There are empires there that swallow armies whole. But, and this is the big but, even in a failed expedition, the most devastating weapon still gets ashore, doesn't it? Smallpox, measles, the flu.
Yes, the great dying. You can't avoid that. A single sick sailor on a failed expedition could still unleash a demographic catastrophe on a continental scale. But the key difference, and this is everything, is the context in which it happens.
What do you mean? A 90% mortality rate is a 90% mortality rate. It's an apocalypse, regardless.
It is. But think about it. In our timeline, the plagues hit at the exact same time as a political and military invasion. The leadership is being captured and killed. The temples are being torn down. Armies are marching through the heartland. All while everyone is dying of diseases they can't comprehend. It's a multi-front collapse. It's psychological, spiritual, and biological, all at once.
Okay, I see where you're going. In this new timeline, the plague arrives, and it's devastating. But the state, the Aztec state, the Inca state, it's still intact. The Sapa Inca is still on his throne. The priests are still there, trying to make sense of it.
They have the social and political infrastructure to respond to the crisis. It's a horrific, generational trauma. But it's a public health crisis, not a simultaneous foreign conquest. They have the capacity to regroup, to rebuild their population over time, to understand what happened, all without a Spanish boot on their neck.
So, the empires are battered, they're demographically shattered, but they survive. They endure. So when the Europeans eventually come back, say in the 1620s or 1630s, what do they find?
They find empires that have been through the fire and have a degree of immunity. And more importantly, they find empires that have had 50 years to process the story of the first failed landings. They now know about Europe. They know about their ships, their steel, their horses.
Oh, wow. So they've had time to adapt? To prepare?
Prepare and demand. The next interaction isn't one of conquest. It can't be. It's one of trade. The Europeans still want the silver and gold, but now they can't just take it. They have to buy it. And what do the Inca and the Aztec want in return? They don't want glass beads. They want the things that almost destroyed them.
You mean they'd be trading for horses, for steel, for firearms?
That is precisely what I mean. Imagine an Incan army of the 1650s, not just with llamas, but with cavalry adapted to the high mountain roads. Imagine Aztec warriors having mastered steel production, meeting European traders on the coast, not with obsidian-edged clubs, but with cannons of their own. The entire technological dynamic is flipped on its head.
That's a staggering thought. It's not a story of conquest anymore. It's the story of two powerful, competing hemispheres warily trading technologies and ideas across a vast ocean. A cold war, almost, before the term even exists.
And think of the knowledge exchange. The Europeans bring the printing press, perhaps, but the Inca, with their sophisticated quipu system of recording information, might adapt that technology in ways we can't even imagine. It's not a replacement of one culture by another. It's a synthesis. A new world, in the truest sense of the word, is born from that delayed contact.
It really is. A synthesis. And what strikes me, listening to you lay that out, is that we've been talking about technology. Steel, horses, guns. But the more profound exchange, the one that truly changes the world, that's in the realm of ideas, isn't it?
How so? Go on.
Well, think about European philosophy, religion, concepts of land ownership, of governance. They arrive in our timeline as a hammer, a tool of conquest that shatters and replaces what was there. But in this alternate 1650, it's not a hammer. It's a negotiation. The concept of the Iroquois Confederacy's great law of peace, or the Inca's complex system of social welfare. These aren't just curiosities to be studied by the conquerors. They are living, breathing political philosophies of rival powers.
So they would have to be taken seriously. They would influence European thought directly. You might have John Locke reading translations of Aztec poetry or political treatises alongside Greek and Roman texts.
Exactly. And that changes everything about the Enlightenment. It creates a world that is genuinely multipolar, not just in terms of power, but in terms of its intellectual foundations. The very definition of what it means to be civilized is suddenly up for debate, with powerful voices on both sides of the ocean.
I find that incredibly compelling. I really do. But I have to wonder if I'm a little more cynical about how it plays out. I don't see a utopia of mutual respect. I see a different kind of conflict. You've just created a global chessboard with more powerful pieces. The Atlantic doesn't become a bridge for ideas so much as a new, massive fault line.
A cold war, like we said, a prolonged stalemate.
A very, very hot stalemate at times, I'd imagine. Because the fundamental drivers haven't changed. Europe still has its population pressures, its resource needs. The Americas now have the means to resist, to push back, to project their own power. What you get isn't conquest, perhaps, but a series of brutal proxy wars fought across two continents for centuries.
So the tragedy isn't averted. It's just drawn out. And maybe even bloodier in the long run, because the sides are more evenly matched. That's a sobering final thought.
It is. And it all comes back to that one fragile moment. A Viking longship, 1,000 years ago, battling a storm. The fact that they made it, saw that land, and created a story. A barely remembered ghost of a story. Was enough to leave a crack in the door. By removing them, we sealed that door so tightly that when it was finally kicked open, the explosion was delayed. But the ingredients for it were that much more potent.
It really makes you realize that history isn't a monolith. It's not this grand, inevitable march. It's a delicate, terrifyingly fragile thread. And a single gust of wind, in the right place, at the right time, can change the pattern forever.
There is no better way to say it. The world we have is not the world that had to be. It's just the one we got. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.